greetings and welcome to Caribbean Forum here on the Uhuru Radio Network, where we expand our ability to communicate and unite the struggles of African people towards victory and independence in our lifetime. I'm Ron Bob Semple, and here on the forum, we'll examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals both at home and across the diaspora. We'll bring you news, views, interviews, thought-provoking discussions, Caribbean theater of the mind, and of course, musical interludes. Well, on the 78th day of the year, the situation in Japan is getting more and more bleak, now that high radiation levels have been found in spinach and milk from farms near its tsunami-crippled nuclear complex. Emergency teams scrambled today to restore power to the plant so it could cool dangerously overheated fuel. While in Libya, Muammar Gaddafi says that the UN resolution authorizing international military intervention in his country is invalid. Wow. The embattled leader said he sent a message to President Barack Obama defending his decision to attack rebel cities, saying, quote, "If you find them taking over American cities by the force of arms, tell me what you would do," unquote. This situation seems as if it will have an ugly resolve. Joining us today under a bit more pleasant circumstance will be John Krizik. He is a well-known plantsman and the owner of the St. Rose Nursery in Grenada. Tomorrow, March 20th, will be an interesting day in the Caribbean, to say the least. In Haiti, voters will go to the polls in a runoff that country's presidential election will be getting on the way later on this year. And what with the return now of deposed President Jean-Bertrand Aristide to Haiti this weekend may add fuel to the existing fire. Guyana is also preparing for its presidential elections later this year, and during our second hour, we hope to be joining a retired Brigadier David Granger, who will be representing the People's National Congress Reform in Guyana. And the small island of Montserrat has produced renowned artists such as the late Calypso Monarch, the Mighty Arrow, and our guest today, Brother Edgar Nkosi White. So tell someone that the Caribbean Forum is on the air. For the next few hours, we heard every Saturday from 9 to 11 Eastern Standard Time on the Uhuru Radio Network. Tomorrow and every Sunday, we'll bring you Golden Sunday Songs from 7 to 10 p.m. when we relive those East easy listening and romantic songs of yesteryear from around the world. We'll be right back with Mr. John Krizik. Here is Ajamu, My Grenada.
Grenada is such a beautiful country, where comfort so much black letters of history. Man, I'm sure that many people will agree if I say she's blessed by the Almighty. Oh God, standard of skills and talent we have down there in this land. It is too much for me to mention, yeah. The level of education keep rising to higher heights. And if I'm wrong, don't say that I'm right. Oh, I want to tell everybody I'm so proud of my country. Don't care wherever I may be, I say Grenada belongs to me. No country in this world could do the things that my country would do for me. I am proud. I love my Grenada, my homeland forever. Sing the chorus louder. Tell them about Grenada, the land of my grandfather. She will always prosper. Oh, my Grenada, land of peace and culture. Grenada is such a paradise. Realize if we learn to pull we hand to the little that we can, we could make Grenada a better land. Mamio, believe it, don't be down, don't be down, don't be down.
Yes, that is Jamu with My Grenada. Here on Caribbean Forum, I'm Ron Bob Semple. I mentioned to the audience that I'll be chatting with the consummate plantsman who owns the St. Rose Nursery in Grenada. Well, Brother John Krizik, good morning and welcome to Caribbean Forum.
Good morning. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, Mr. Krizik, you were born in Essex, London. You immigrated to South America in 1961, and you moved to Grenada in 1972, where you have been living since. What motivated you to make this transatlantic move?
When I was 6 years old, I announced to the grown-ups that I wasn't going to live in England when I was grown up. And even in those days, I somehow knew that I wanted to leave England and live in more places more attractive to me.
And you found Grenada to be so? Well, South America and then Grenada to be so?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Because by the end of my education, I was attending Reading University, and I met a Guyanese student called Alfred Downer. And he became a good friend of mine. And I asked him about his country. He said, well, it's 5/8 rainforest, very undeveloped, multiracial, English-speaking, within 8 degrees of the equator. I thought, well, that's it.
All of that qualified you to make that consideration to move.
Yeah, it certainly did.
Mr. Krizik, I have known you for most of my adult life. Explain to our listeners how this came about, please.
I got a job at Central High School. I was art master teaching painting and drawing. And I set up an art room downstairs at the floor level, ground level. And I was teaching children from the first form, which would be 11 years old, to right up to 18 years old, pre-university level. And so one of my students was a boy called Ronald Bob Semple. And he's one whose name I've never forgotten.
Okay.
I have a little picture somewhere of him actually sitting at the table in the art room doing a painting.
Wow. Now, you have to send me a copy of that, Mr. Krizik.
I know, I do.
It certainly was a pleasure being in your class. And in addition to art, you also taught French at Central High School. Isn't that so?
I certainly did. I don't know if you can remember me teaching you to sing the French national anthem.
Absolutely. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Absolutement.
Because
some of your fellow students I know are listening to us this morning, and as you well know that there's been a lot of turmoil around this world, and with the weather pattern around the world changing, and the recent earthquake and subsequent tsunami in Japan, how concerned should the Caribbean be in event of such a disaster hitting the region, and what contingency plans are being made in Grenada and in the region as a whole, to the best of your knowledge, sir?
Well, to the best of my knowledge is only what I see in the newspapers. And I'm always seeing that there are meetings and conferences to do with climate change. But I am yet to be made aware of what concrete steps are actually being taken. It's difficult for me to imagine what could prevent disaster. For example, St. George's is right at sea level, and a tsunami would be totally devastating.
Absolutely.
I think that, you know, we do have a volcano just north of us under the sea. It's called Kekemgeni. It's one of the biggest in the Caribbean. And if that erupted in a major way, we would, within minutes, we'd have a tsunami in St. George's.
How many Grenadians know of that fact? I mean, the existence of that volcano.
I think they know that Kikamjeni is there and that there's something volcanic about it. I don't really think that the majority of Grenadians are aware just how dangerous it is. But let's face it, it hasn't erupted within living memory or even within recorded history. So nobody's going to get really very worried about it.
But don't you think they should, because of one, the fact that, you know, that 9.0 in Japan, and just a couple of months ago, even the volcano in the Soufriere Hills in Montserrat again erupted. Shouldn't one be concerned that these patterns are probably telling a tale to us?
Well, certainly we should be concerned. Grenadians are not a people to get very concerned about things, quite honestly. They just carry on with their lives, and difficult to get them to take such things very seriously, you know.
Isn't that a pattern throughout the Caribbean, not just in Grenada?
I'm pretty sure you're right about that. Oh, yes, it's not specially Grenadian, no. But I can remember telling children a few years ago when we were being warned about a tsunami, it must have been after the Indonesian one, yes. I can remember telling children who I was involved with, who were attending schools in St. George's, that if they felt the ground shaking, they should rush to a point where they can see the sea. And if they see a wave coming, they must run uphill as fast as they can. That's the best advice I could give anybody.
You as an individual are giving that advice. Is the government involved in disseminating that kind of information to the populace at large?
No, they're not. It's a very long time since I heard anybody say that to the public. So you really put me on the alert now, and I think I should take steps to write to the newspapers and things like that.
I think we all should. But in your case, Mr. Krizik, where the growing of plants is essential, remembering when Hurricane Ivan made a direct hit on Grenada in 2004, how much damage was done to the St. Rose Nursery?
Oh, absolutely, almost total devastation. I had two very large Ficus benjamina trees, which are quite popular in Florida, and they were totally uprooted. It is not a good tree to plant if you are hurricane prone, because they roots. And these trees just crashed down onto my greenhouses, squashing everything flat. The mess was, well, it's when I look at the pictures of Japan now and the mess everywhere, it reminds me of what it was like after Ivan, because you couldn't take a step in any direction without treading on some kind of debris. Everything was covered in debris. Sheets of iron, roofing sheets had flown off houses and were lying all over the place. Trees were lying across the road. It took me 20 minutes just to get to my gate from my house because of all the fallen trees and stuff on the ground.
How much longer after Ivan hit Grenada did it take for not only St. Rose Nursery, but the island at large to get back to some sense of normalcy?
Well, I think very, very basic things were achieved, like, all the roads being cleared and so on, within a year. But it depended on the area where you lived as to whether you got electricity. I had to wait a long time because I live where there aren't too many houses. And I have it noted down somewhere. I think I waited 2.25 years to get back electricity.
Two and a quarter years? to get back electricity.
Yes. And we received a lot of help. We had crews from Trinidad working on putting back the power lines, because all the poles were lying on the ground, you see. And all the wires had to be replaced with new wires. And we had teams from Cuba. They were wonderful, too. But I was so annoyed. They nearly reached my house just before Christmas. And suddenly, they all went back to Cuba for Christmas holidays on the 15th of December, I think they left. And in fact, they never came back. I had to wait again and again for another crew to come to connect me. And then we got connection with cable again. That came after the electricity. TV itself, yes, cable. And what's the other thing? Telephone. We were without telephones for a very long time.
Speaking of Cuba, in 2003, you traveled to Cuba on a mission, and you detailed that trip in a fascinating document. What was that mission, and why was it so dear to you, Mr. Krizek?
Well, it sort of became so after I had decided that I want to go and see what Cuba is like for myself. Because one hears and reads so much about it, but seeing it for yourself is something different. I wanted to see what is life like for Cubans. I don't want to go as a tourist. I know they have a lot of tourist hotels and beaches and so on. That doesn't interest me. I wanted to see Cuba. And just before I left, I found that one of the workers who was working for me on a landscaping project, when I told him I'm going to Cuba, he said, "Oh, my father is Cuban." And I said, "Really?" And it turned out that his father had been one of the workers building our airport during the revolutionary years, 1979 to 1983. And he was driving a truck. And he had linked up with a young Grenadian girl, and he had two sons by her. And then, he went home before the invasion, and the invasion took place, and he never returned to Grenada. So these boys grew up not knowing who their father was. And so I said to him, "I'm going to find your father." Now, that's a bold claim to make if you look at the map and see Cuba.
Where do I start?
Yeah, where do you start? I mean, it's as big as Florida. But I did it. I found his father.
A little later on, I'm going to ask you to share with our listeners part of that document that you wrote. But give us one of the sections of that document, Mr. Krizek. It struck me, and I'd like to ask you before I say that you marveled at seeing a BC taxi or a rickshaw, as they're called, being peddled by a white man pulling an African man who reclined smoking a cigar.
Right.
Why did that picture have such an effect on you?
Because it's so opposite to everything that West Indians have grown up with. I can remember a Guyanese friend of mine, of course you know who I'm talking about, Wordsworth McAndrew.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to London to do a BBC course. And when he got there, they put him in a hotel or some kind of accommodation where his room was actually level with the pavement. You know, it was a basement. So he could look through a window and actually be looking at people's feet walking past, you know. And so he got up his first morning in England, and he was looking out of this window, and to his amazement, he saw what he called white boys, you know, young white men, coming and picking up the garbage cans and emptying the contents into a truck, you know. And he said, "You've never seen white people do things like that." in the West Indies, you know? It was a reversal of the roles, that's all.
A reversal of the roles.
Yes.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network. We are chatting with John Krizik. He is a plantsman and the owner of the St. Rose Nursery in Grenada. And we're talking about a fascinating trip that he made to Cuba about some 8 years ago. If you'd like to join us in discourse here on Caribbean Forum, if you're calling within the United States, you can give us a call at area code 727-565-1599. That's 727-565-1599. If you're calling from across the pond in the United Kingdom, you can call us at 44-020-8133-6629. You can also Skype us. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio. That's U-H-U-R-U Radio. Mr. Krizik, if you can, sir, just set up the scene that you will read for us. I would say that you're reading a part of this passage that could fall right into the category of our Caribbean Theater of the Mind segment here on Caribbean Forum. So if you can just set our listeners up for the section of that document that you'll read for us. And first of all, what's the title of that piece and what does it mean?
Okay. Patria es humanidad. I have later on singled out a piece in which I talk about the meaning of that. So I would like to come to it rather than search for it right now. What I've done, I've selected a few passages to read. Could I start now?
Yes, you certainly can.
All right. I just arrived in Cuba the night before, and I've been shown to my room in a casa particular, which is a kind of, it's a private house where the owner is allowed to accommodate foreign visitors, no Cubans are allowed in there, for a price. And this is a government, permitted. It's legal. They usually charge about 25 US a night with breakfast. So here I am waking up in the morning. Towards morning, I got up to pee and looked out of the small window high above my bedhead. I could see a patch of black sky with a star twinkling. I looked at my watch and was amazed to see it was 7 a.m. I was too sleepy to work out exactly why, but realized that I had come very far north and, most important, very far west. I went back to bed and tried to doze off. As it got light, I lay there listening to the sound of women's voices and then the smell of something cooking, perhaps frying, not very recognizable but quite appetizing. I decided to get up. Looking out of the window again, I saw it had wrought iron bars outside. I could see right into what looked like the kitchen of the building next door. I could hear women's voices nearby, but the kitchen was empty. Everything looked at least 40 years old, and there was very little of it. An old chair and a shelf with some sweet potatoes on it. A stove. Nothing else. Substitute potatoes for sweet potatoes, and it might have been in the Warsaw ghetto. Shaving in the bathroom, I speculated that the white tiles must be original. They had a tiled dado in dark jade green. But when was the building built? I went out through the sitting room to the balcony. My first view of Cuba. I was shocked and delighted at the same time. I was looking down a street like a chasm between picturesque, ornate buildings with balconies like the one I was standing on. Down below, people were walking up and down the street, some pushing hand carts. The general impression was of crumbling shabbiness, with lots of washing hanging out, as in a Neapolitan street. It was fairly quiet. The old gentleman who apparently owned this casa particular He bade me sit down at the breakfast table laid for 6 places. He busied himself in the kitchen and soon came out with a plate piled with cubes of papaya and a pink-fleshed guava cut in quarters, a jug of orange juice, black coffee, and a jug of warm milk. Next came 2 fried eggs. I asked for them to be suave, i.e. soft, and a plate heaped high with strange puff-of-air bread, which is how bread is in Cuba, and someone told me that that's how bread is in Russia. Also, there was margarine and honey. There was salt on the table and black pepper. I looked at the container of black pepper. It was imported from Spain, which does not produce black pepper. I reflected that Cuba could easily produce its own black pepper. Well, that is my first passage.
It's I must say, Mr. Krizik, and I mentioned in an email that I sent to you congratulating you on this piece of writing. It was absolutely extraordinary, and the mere fact that you remembered in detail that entire trip. We'll hear from you in a little bit, another section of that document. It's now 27 minutes after the hour. You're listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple. My special guest this morning is my high school art teacher from Central High School in Guyana, Mr. John Krizik. We'll be right back after these words.
Hi, I'm Alan Bomar Jones, and you're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple.
Tune into Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 a.m. on the Uhuru Radio Network. We examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. If you're not listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network, then your radio is not on.
This is Alan Bomar Jones. The Uhuru Radio Network gives a voice to the voiceless and stands for freedom for African people everywhere. Support it with your contribution today. This is Alan Bomar Jones. The Uhuru Radio Network has news and culture direct from Africa, the Caribbean, and wherever Africans are working, playing, and fighting to be free. Support it today. Hi, I'm Alan Bomar Jones, and I...
Yes, welcome back. Welcome back to Caribbean Forum here on the Uhuru Radio Network. I'm Ron Bob Semple with Mr. John Krizik out of Grenada. We're chatting an extraordinary trip that he made to Cuba back in 2003. Mr. Krizik, the Cuban government spends a lot of money giving free education to foreign students when the country is desperately poor. Apparently, this does not cause resentment among Cubans, does it?
Well, I am told, I was told at the time when I was there that it doesn't. But that was the opinion of one person. I haven't really been able to talk to more people about that. But I think it's been going on for a long time and they rather accept it. I do feel that, you know, it's Cuba spends so much money helping other nations that it must seem a little bit unfair to their own people, because their own lives really do need a lot of improvement. So I can't answer that question very definitely.
Because I know Guyanese and other Caribbean nationals have spent a lot of time in Cuba studying. There are a lot of doctors that have come out of that that institution there in Cuba. Cuba has very recently, if I remember correctly, built a few hospitals in Guyana. And then Fidel Castro, I know that a lot of people have said many negative things about his regime, but the mere fact that they have an education system which is free from, what is it, kindergarten to university, you know, that regime has to be complimented, because education today is so critical in moving forward. And a little later on in the program, we're scheduled to have Brigadier David Granger, who is running for the presidency of Guyana. And he had a rather important meeting just earlier this week at the University of Guyana in Turkine with the students and staff there. If you can, Mr. Krizik, if you can just move on to your second piece there from that document, that trip that you made to Cuba.
Yes, I'd like to give you a little glimpse now to sort of give you some atmosphere. I must tell you that I was very, very lucky that I had a Cuban friend to go around with. He had the time, he wasn't doing anything, he had been working in Grenada where I'd met him, and he offered to accompany me on my trip around Cuba, so it made all the difference for me. In the account I've written, I've called him Eliseo, which is not his real name. A little further on, I suggested to Eliseo that we take a beer somewhere. We came to a kind of beer garden that was rather run down and dingy. It was full of people drinking beer and talking. This was a peso place, meaning that they accepted the common Cuban currency rather than the so-called dollar pesos. Prices, therefore, extremely low. Eliseo said that the beer is awful and he didn't recommend it. I thought I would try it, so we ordered two. It was really dreadful, but it only cost about US 10 cents. The place was popular because this is what most Cubans can afford to drink. It was dismal and there were flies. As we came away, Eliseo said, "You see, in the peso places you get bad service and poor quality. In the dollar places you get good service and good quality. But if you're earning $11 or $12 a month, how can you afford to drink Bucanero, the best and strongest beer, at US 85 cents a bottle?" So I thought that gave a little atmosphere, and I want to go on now to speaking to Rafael, the young man in Grenada who told me his father is Cuban, and this was what I asked him. "Have you ever seen your father?" I asked. "No, never." "What's his name?" "I don't know his surname, but his first name is Rafael, like me. And his nickname is Caballo Loco." "What kind of man would be called Crazy Horse?" I thought to myself. "Well, Rafael," we call him Rafael in Grenada, I said, "I'm going to try and find your father." I had to act quickly as there was little time left. I remembered that a young woman named Beverly had had a baby during the Grenadian Revolution. There was a chance she might have known Rafael's father, as she lived in the same area as Rafael. I telephoned her at her workplace. Yes, she had known Caballo Loco, but she didn't know his real name. He was indeed a truck driver. However, she was going to give me the name and address of her son's father, Armando Malagon, in Matanzas. She felt sure that Caballo Loco would have been from Matanzas too. This was a tremendous lead. I felt determined to find this man. I took a photograph of Rafael, which I was very pleased with. Rafael's young brother, Damian, was also fathered by Caballo Loco, but there was no time to find him and photograph him. "Wouldn't your mother know your father's name?" I asked. Rafael said he didn't want to ask her. I imagined she might not look too favorably upon a man who had given her two children and then left her to look after them all by herself. "If I find your father, what do you want me to tell him?" I asked. "Tell him he has two sons in Grenada," Rafael said. Well, I want to go on now to when I actually managed to find
Rafael's father. That was interesting, please.
Yeah, I'm just leafing through the... I've got it printed out in hard copy, and I've marked it, but it comes a little bit further on. Ah, yes. Now, we were staying with Armando, and of course you're not allowed to stay in Cuban houses, but he didn't seem to care and was taking a risk. And we had dinner there. After emerging from our rooms, Armando offered some cold beer. The dinner was, guess what, fried pork and arroz moro and fried plantains. Well, I said guess what because all you can get to eat in Cuba most of the time is pork. And it's very often fried. The 1955 Buick was kept in a locked garage next to the pig pen. We were encouraged to park our car as closely as possible to this locked garage for security reasons, I imagined. I was continually to see such signs that crime of larceny is prevalent, or at least expected. Once out on the road, the Buick butted along at rather a scary pace, the more so because bicycles in Cuba don't carry lights. Our picture of the iron-fisted rule in a totalitarian state often has to undergo some serious adjustments. So here we were, flying through the night along a straight road across a level landscape, trying to search the darkness ahead for cyclists, stray animals, or horse-drawn vehicles. The last did sometimes carry a feeble light, but often none at all. Our speed was due to a Russian engine which Armando had installed in the Buick. I marveled at the way these things could be made to fit. Surely Cubans put us in the free world to shame when it comes to vehicles. What we throw on junk heaps, they preserve as useful, functional means of transport. In Cardenas, that's a town, in Cardenas, people were sitting in chairs on the pavement outside their houses in typical Latin fashion. Armando stopped and talked to them, and then moved on to another street and asked more people. Eventually, we arrived in a dark street outside some very poor houses. I didn't think Armando was going to find Caballo Loco that night. Then Eliseo said he thought Armando was going to find him soon. "Do you think so?" I said. The next thing I heard was Armando coming back to the car and saying, "Mira el hombre! Look at him!" In amazement, I got out of the car. In the doorway of a house, I could see a man saying, "Entre, entre." I went in, and in the light of a single bulb, I saw a man with a most extraordinarily wrinkled face. As I sat down, I saw that even his nose was deeply wrinkled. This dismayed me quite a bit, because I thought it would be a shock for Rafael to see his father looking like that. I asked him, "Usted es Caballo Loco?" "Sí, sí," he answered. I asked him if he could speak English. "I forget," he said. Through Eliseo, I told him that I was from Grenada, en vacaciones, and that I had been searching for him because a young man in Grenada had told me that his father lives in Cuba, but he has never seen him and doesn't even know his name. I told him that I was going to try and find his father. The young man's name is Rafael. Caballo Loco kept nodding at all this, as though waiting for me to come to the point. He then asked if there was another one. "Yes," I replied, "his name is Damian." I told him that I asked Rafael what he wanted me to say to his father, and that Rafael had said, "Tell him he has two sons in Grenada." I said that the two young men want to know who their father is, and they want to know his name. Tears began to roll down the leathery, wrinkled cheeks. I was glad that he was crying. I felt that he should cry and face up to his responsibilities. I remembered that Rafael and Beverly had both told me that Rafael's mother had been very young at the time when Caballo Loco began to have sexual relations with her, perhaps as young as 16, whereas Caballo Loco was about 35 at that time. Soon he was able to compose himself and said how he wished he had something in the house to offer us. The living room was fairly bare. A bicycle was leaning against the wall, and there were some chairs and a television set, which was not on. Eliseo was later to say that he thought Caballo Loco probably had financial problems. His standard of living contrasted strongly with that of Armando.
Wow. Mr. Krizika, we just have a few more minutes left in this segment. Is this article a precursor to a short film or a major motion picture?
Well, I wish it was. It would be lovely to do that.
Okay, I'm just putting the seed out there, Mr. Krizika.
Yeah, right. It could mean going back to Cuba too.
Well, right. Absolutely. I think it would be it'd be fascinating to see this story played out on celluloid. Mr. Krizika, yes. How would you describe the relationship between Cuba and Grenada?
Oh, it's undoubtedly very friendly. During our revolution, Fidel sort of almost adopted Morris Bishop as his mascot sort of thing, and they were very, very close. And so the public in Cuba became very much aware of Grenada. And then, of course, when the Americans invaded, they knew all about that, obviously. And subsequently, there was a sort of official and unofficial benevolent regard for Cuba, for Grenada. And as a Grenadian, I'm a citizen of Grenada now. As a Grenadian, I enjoyed this sort of privilege, you might say. I think that it's what made it possible for me to stay in Cuban homes, because if the authorities did find out about it, I think the fact that I was from Grenada would probably count in my favor.
Mm. Well, Mr. Krizika, it has been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure chatting with you here on Caribbean Forum. And if anyone is going to Grenada in the future and would like to see that fabulous nursery, the St. Rose's Nursery, how can one get in contact with you, sir?
Well, the best thing is to telephone me on arrival. My number is 473-440-5870.
Repeat that, please.
Yes, also my email address, which is not very easy to give out as spoken, is another way of getting in touch with me. It's krizik@spiceisle.com, and Krizik is spelled CRISWICK, and spiceisle is all one word, .com.
Well, Mr. Krizik, thank you very much, and all the best to you and your staff there at St. Rose Nursery in Grenada.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been very enjoyable.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yeah, that was John Krizika chatting with us from Grenada. And it is a fascinating story that he's written on that trip that he made to Cuba back in 2003. As I mentioned a little earlier, tomorrow, March 20th, will be the runoff in Haiti between Michel Martelly and Madeleine Madigat. And with the arrival of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, it's very, very interesting to find out exactly what the atmosphere would be like tomorrow.
Listening to WooRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
I just love it.
Let's take it from our hearts and spread it wide.
God brings fire from my brothers and sisters.
My neighbors. We got a long road ahead.
Yeah.
Put together we can do this.
It's a Caribbean collaboration.
All my brothers and sisters, let the love flow, let the love show.
We're not as big as that. It's all about strength. Let's rise. Life, pressure, strength.
struggle, strain. Must stand together, let us shoulder the pain. Me can't tell your witness blood a run down the drain. Me can't stand helpless and a half a ear.
No, I would never ever turn and walk away. When we stop and take a good, good look in at your face. No time for wasting, my man, my brother's keeper. I'm his enemy, so now I got to search and I'm a soul deeper.
How can I stop my heart from breaking? What can I do to ease the pain? How can I stop the earth from shaking? Searching for strength to keep me sane.
What can we do to make it better? Is it too late for us to try?
Now I rethink the things I treasure. A fragment of hope is in these eyes. We shall rise again.
We shall rise and spread our wings once again.
We shall rise again.
The help from our brothers and our friends.
We shall rise again.
We've done it before, now we can do it once again.
We shall rise again.
Take a bit of help from our family and friends.
A moment of change and now we're spinning. No warning is sent, no reason why. To do what it takes to save some lives. Oh no, no.
Tragedy came and really gave us
a chance to show
we really care. The world understands we are neighbors. The burden is over for us to bear. We shall
together and let's solve the problem. Problem. Everybody got them. Work them, I make the money, so they don't wanna solve it. In the days and the nights will fall, but I know we'll carry on. Now it's time for us to stay strong. So let's come together.
We shall rise again.
actually got there and I could actually see with my own eyes, I could not believe what was happening to the country.
This is the presidential palace down.
To see those collapsed buildings, the hospitals, the banks, the universities, knowing that there are people buried underneath.
This is the situation here. They're digging from a supermarket that collapsed, so they're finding food underneath. So the minute they stop, everybody's gonna rush in, and whatever they find, instead of finding some food, they might find some human body.
At that particular time, they told me that this is what and how the end of the world is going to look like. I'll probably say, okay, because that's exactly what some of the places in Haiti looked like the end of the world.
The thing is, they don't have enough space to put them, so they just have to burn them. So what they have here is a pile of bodies. That's the only way. Otherwise, they have too many bodies. What they do is they just pile them. They pile them in the truck. And they just burn the truck. They just put it out there and just burn it. That's the only way. It's been going on ever since the first day. This is the fourth day right now. Today, just around where I live, I saw tens of bodies that are being burned. And they do that every 1 or 2 hours. Devastating, and that's without saying about the state of the country. Everywhere you go, everything is dead. Everything needs to be done again in Haiti. I don't know how we're gonna do it.
10% of the Haitian kids die before the age of 5. 75% of the Haitian kids do not attend school. More than half of the Haitian people live with $1 a day. Yeah, this is Jimmy Jean-Louis. I was born in Haiti and I enjoyed my times that I lived in Haiti. But now being in Hollywood, I realize that Haiti is not doing well. I've been visiting Haiti and it's heartbreaking to see the situation down there, the ways people are living, the ways kids are being abandoned. Something needs to be done. We need to help them. We need to unite. We all need to unite for Haiti.
With everything you try, just look them in the eye and hold your head up to the sky. Persevere.
Jimmy, thank you for doing this.
No, thank you.
And it's great to see the beautiful people here.
Yeah.
The beautiful people and the joy with which people carry themselves. Mm-hmm.
The spirit of Haitian is pretty high, you know, most of the time. It's just a shame to see the country in such a situation.
But we're going to tell people about it.
Exactly. We'd scream loud.
We're here for Jimmy for Hollywood United for Haiti.
Hollywood unites. Hollywood unites.
Hollywood unites.
Hollywood unites.
Hollywood unites for Haiti.
Hollywood unites.
Hollywood unites for Haiti.
Hi, I'm Brandon Ralph, and here to support Hollywood United for Haiti.
Hollywood unites for Haiti.
Hollywood unites for Haiti.
Hollywood United for Haiti.
Godspeed.
The result is right there, because we're able to get money for the PADF and the OAS and Hollywood Unites for Haiti to do this kind of work.
The reason why it's so well organized is because it's people from those areas that are doing the work and not some organization. I mean, it is through the PADF, but we're really using people from the neighborhood. So that's why they're able to identify
the right people and they know them by name and by where they live. Okay. If it was from some an organization coming from outside, it would be impossible. They wouldn't know who those people are, where they live, if they're lying or not. So, you know, that's why it's important to use the Haitians.
The money's actually going.
No, but to specifically use the people from the neighborhood that need the help. Guys, watch out as you come down. C'est eux même qui fait. Ah, that's good to know. Parce que c'est moi qui t'ai voyé.
Ok.
That's good to hear. Like some of the work that we did, you know, we helped actually cleaning this place. Those places, you know, nobody can actually go and help them with the big bulldozers. It's impossible to get in. That's why they're struggling as far as getting any help. And they're the ones that actually really need the help, because those people have nothing left.
Yes, you've been listening to Jimmy Jean Louis, the Haitian-born actor who has been doing a lot for his native land in Haiti. At the moment, I don't know if he's returned yet, but at the moment he's in France. He's in France filming a movie on the life of Toussaint Louverture. And not just Hollywood, but we all need to unite for Haiti. As I mentioned earlier, tomorrow is the runoff for the elections in Haiti, for the presidential elections between Michel Martelly and Marlinda Madigat, the former first lady. And it was scheduled that Jean-Bertrand Aristide would have been returning to Haiti, and with Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier still in Haiti. It's very, very interesting what that atmosphere could be like when the Haitians are going to cast their vote tomorrow. We wish Haiti all the best. And it's almost the top of the hour. We are going to go to the Caribbean news brief, and then we'll try to make contact with David Granger in Guyana.
News in brief from News Americas Now. I'm Ken Lang. Roger Bantin is set to be sentenced in June. Haitians are set to vote for a new president. And Rihanna has something to say about her father. I'll be back with the details after this. This is Ken Webb inviting you to the 21st Annual Boscoff's Berks Jazz Festival, Thursday, March 31st through Sunday, April 3rd in Reading, Pennsylvania. So log on to kenwebb.com, Channel 2, for the live stream and updated information about the festival. Thursday, March 31st through Sunday, April 3rd. We'll be looking for you. Convicted Jamaican-born reggae star Buju Banton is now set to be sentenced later this June, News Americas has learned. Banton, born Mark Anthony Myrie, is now set to be sentenced at 9 a.m. on Thursday, June 23rd, instead of June 16th, in a Tampa court by Judge James S. Moody, Jr. The singer was found guilty of three cocaine-related charges in February, including conspiracy to possess with an intent to distribute 5 kilograms of cocaine. The new date was revealed this week as Judge Moody also dismissed the attempting to possess 5 kilograms or more of cocaine charge against Banton, who was found not guilty of the charge at the trial last month. Haitians are set to vote for a new president on Sunday, March 20th. Voters will have to decide whether they want Coppa singer Michelle Sweet Mickey Martelly or Marlene Manigat to take the reins of leadership from current President René Préval.
Martelli has picked up the support of five former challengers as the countdown begins to the runoff election. This as the U.S. urged former president Jean-Bertrand Aristide to stay in exile until after the election. Caribbean-born attorney Margot Brody has been recommended by a New York senator to serve as a judge on the prestigious United States District Court for the Eastern District of New York. If confirmed, the Antigua-born Brody will be the only Caribbean-born federal judge to serve in the United States. She would also be the only judge of Caribbean descent on either the United States District Court for the Eastern District of New York or the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York. U.S. Senator Schumer cited her experience, even-handed temperament, years of varied public service, and stellar legal credentials in making his recommendation. The current cholera death toll in Haiti could climb as high as 11,000, U.S. researchers said Tuesday. Jason Andrews of the Harvard School of Public Health and other researchers claim the threat from the cholera epidemic in Haiti is much higher than U.N. agencies projected, and the epidemic is likely to sicken close to 800,000 people. This is your Caribbean News in brief from News Americas Now. Bombarded by news but still can't find concise information on Latin America and the Caribbean in one place? Well, look no further than NewsAmericasNow.com. Get to your computer, point your browser to NewsAmericasNow.com. That's NewsAmericasNow.com. NewsAmericasNow.com. On the ET scene, Grammy-winning Bajan singer Rihanna, born Robin Fenty, is dissing her father in a new Vogue magazine interview. The singer revealed her displeasure over her father's actions after the assault at the hands of former boyfriend Chris Brown. And she also said that her father, Ronald Fenty, never called her, but went straight to the press and got a check. And in sports, the West Indies' run in the ICC Cricket World Cup is almost over. The Windies lost to England Thursday by 18 runs, and with it lost a chance to enter the quarterfinals of the competition. Andre Russell grabbed 4 wickets for 49 runs, while adding a top score of 49 with the bat. The Windies will play their last World Cup match on March 20th against India. That's this week's Caribbean News in brief from News Americas Now. Until next week, I'm Ken Webb.
You're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bobsemple here on the Uhuru Radio Network.
You're listening to uhururadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Do you know of El Dorado, the ancient story told about that fabled city whose streets were lined with gold? The news was heard by Riley, and a search was soon begun. Setting sun, they traveled up the rivers, searched mountains great and tall, and found that priceless treasure, the mighty Kaito Falls. Do you know? That fabled city whose streets were lined with gold. They asked the Amerindians about this golden city.
Guyana's beauty, Guyana so green and graceful, caressed by the ocean breeze, a people so proud and peaceful, and a land of mystery. Do you know of El Dorado, the ancient story told about that fabled city, whose streets were lined with gold? Do you know of El Dorado, the ancient story told about that fabled city, whose streets were lined with gold? El Dorado.
Yes, that's El Dorado. El Dorado, sung by Bill Newman out of Canada. Bill Newman, better known as the crooner. El Dorado, the streets that are lined with gold. British Guyana, now Guyana, got her independence on this May 26, 1966. We were hoping to make contact with Mr. David Granger, who is the candidate that will be representing the People's National Congress Reform at the upcoming elections in Guyana. I know there's been some serious rain and flooding in Guyana, but in lieu of having Mr. Granger on, I'd like to share with you part of a forum that was held earlier this week, I think on Wednesday, at the University of Guyana. And among the speakers were Mr. Granger, in addition to Attorney James Bond. He was one of the candidates who was also running for the candidacy to represent the PNCR. Here are both Attorney James Bond and Mr. David Granger at the University of Guyana in Turkey.
Our next speaker for this evening's activities serves as a central executive member to the PNCR. He opted to participate in the People's National Congress for presidential hopefuls and was the youngest of the group of nominees vying to be the chosen presidential candidate for the PNCR One Guyana. He has studied at the University of Guyana during the period 1997 to 2000 and at the U Wooding Law School. He now practices law and serves under the Constitution of Guyana. He has endorsed the new presidential candidate and will be enlightening you on the conscience of intellect. Please welcome Attorney at Law, James Bond.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My address to you is entitled The Conscience of Intellect. Guyana today stands at a political, economic, social and cultural crossroads. And more than ever, the direction she takes will ultimately define her future success and future failure. The responsibility, therefore, falls upon the shoulders of our generation to assert ourselves and ensure that the enormous promise and potential we have been divinely blessed with finally bears fruit. Indeed, the challenges of crime, poverty, the widening gap between the haves and the have-nots in our society, as a result of corruption and mismanagement of our nation's wealth, the inadequacies of education and healthcare system, the gross and brazen violations of basic human rights, the inaccessibility to information, and barbaric monopoly of state media, and the degradation of the sanctity of our constitution are great, but these challenges are not insurmountable. History has always been on the side of the challenge of the challenge. Moreover, history has shown that in most instances, the challenger has been students and young people, devoid of fear and partisanship, who have changed the course of their country when it lingered near the brink of inter-ethnic strife, economic disaster, and global irrelevance. Permit me moments to highlight a few instances. On February 21st, 1973, law students of the Athens Polytechnic in Greece demanded the repeal of a law that compulsorily deducted subversive students by striking and barricading themselves inside campus buildings. The actions of the state to crush the struggle for justice and freedom resulted in greater demonstrations outside of the campus by fellow Greeks who joined in solidarity. And on November the 14th, 1973, the campus became the symbol of the struggle against the dictatorial and powerful junta ruling Greece and the catalyst of its eventual fall. On the 16th of June, 1976, high school students in Soweto, South Africa, protested for better education as there were a severe lack of facilities, overcrowded classrooms, inhuman public-to-teacher ratios, and in general, the system of apartheid, which spent 644 rand on a white child's education, but only 42 rand on a black child's. Further, the imposition of Afrikaans, which was seen as the language of the oppressor, as the medium of instruction in schools of higher learning, culminated in such attitudes as this, and I quote, "Our parents are prepared to suffer under the white man's rule. They have been living for years under these laws, and they have become immune to them. But we strongly refuse to swallow an education that is designed to make us slaves in the country of our birth. The spirit of equality and freedom that empowered the demonstrations of denouncement that ensued was too powerful for the abominable regime of apartheid in South Africa. And today, the fruits of success are evident for the world to see, where blacks and whites are students in the same schools enjoying the same quality of education. Will you, the students of the University of Ghana, accept an education that makes you paupers and jobless in your own country?" On March the 14th, 2010, students across the campuses of the University of California held protests against draconian cuts to public education by the state of California. The enduring sentiment of the protests was best described by Robert Cruikshank, a journalist and speaker of the protest, when he wrote, "Students now understand what is happening to them and why. Their education is being gutted and their already meager financial resources are being stolen from them by a state government that believes corporations are more important than students. Who is this PPPC government saying matters more to you? The students of UG. When they unconscionably, unconsciously, negatively treat with your needs present and your needs future by underfunding your education. I must also pay homage to the students of Tiananmen Square, China, Tunisia, Libya, Bahrain, Iran, and Egypt that stood and declared enough is enough to totalitarianism. One man rule and regimes who by their neglect of the youth population's basic needs had lost their right to govern. Lest I fail them and lest I forget, I pay them homage. I have had the privilege of being part of a true democratic process initiated by the PNCR, where I was allowed to contest for the post of presidential candidate of the party. Brigadier David Granger was also vying for that seat of service. During our town hall meetings across the length and breadth of this country, I have sat next to him at all times, with the exception of Queenstown and Madia, to say that during those meetings I have come to admire his deft leadership, sound judgment, burgeoning intellect, crisp wit, and such integrity that make mankind consummate. My observations, however, would pale to what his friends would say of him. Young Guyanese, as I have, reverberate with excitement at the prospects of seeing their every good dream and wish on the verge of realization with his victory at the PNCR primaries and his inevitable victory at the national elections later this year. My fellow youths, the time has come when we must join the ranks of Brigadier David Granger and be counted on the side of justice and fairness, peace and prosperity. Our physical and economic insecurities have for far too long been neglected by an incompetent and uncaring People's Progressive Party Civic. In 2011, we must seize this moment. This is the choice our collective futures hinges upon. His passion for history, the arts and sciences, human development, and all learning are unmatched, and he is rewarded no less than the Medal of Service, something none of the aspirants for or holders of public office possess. I do believe that if we, the youth of the nation, put our confidence in and rally around the People's General, David Granger, our university will be saved, our Guyana will be saved. Any less decisive action and all will be lost. I appeal to the conscience of your intellect. Thank you.
Thank you, James, for such an outstanding presentation. At this time, I would like to call on Ms. Maureen Philadelphia to formally introduce and welcome the main speaker for this activity. I give you Ms. Maureen Philadelphia.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Brigadier retired David Granger, members of the head table, audience, colleagues, all special invitees, a special good evening. The honor and privilege is mine to introduce to you a special person for this evening proceeding. That person's life is grounded in traditional Guyanese values. He was born into a large family with strong roots in the public service and grew up in the three counties, Essequibo, Demerara, and Burby. He was educated at Queen's College and graduated from the University of Guyana, where he received his bachelor's and master's degree. He also attended the University of the West Indies, the University of Maryland, and the National Defense University in the USA. David Granger's years of military service are based on his belief in Guyana's independence and territorial integrity. Brigadier Granger made a significant contribution to national defense and public security as a member of several defense and security agencies. He served in several public organizations where he was elected to presidencies of the History Society, Guyana Heritage Society, University of Guyana, Guild of Graduates, and the Guyana Chess Federation. Brigadier Granger has written extensively on national defense and public security issues. I now take the honor in presenting to you David Granger.
Thank you very much, Maureen, for your kind introduction. Madam Chairperson, colleagues at the head table, lecturers and staff of the university, young people, fellow young people. I'm very happy to be here this evening. As Maureen has explained, I have very long experience in the university as a student, as a lecturer, as a member of the university council, and as president of the University Guild of Graduates. My mistake was to have to study at the St. Augustine campus at the University of the West Indies and at the Maryland, at the University of Maryland campus at College Park. And you can't help but compare the campuses, and you can't help but wonder why can't University of Guyana be like St. Augustine or Mona or Cave Hill. I leave College Park out for the time being. We are faced with a challenge tonight. I'm not going to follow the line of Mr. James Bond to do what the Greeks and other people have done. But you have to make some decisions. 2 years from now, just 2 years from now, this university will be celebrating its 50th anniversary in 2013. This campus, this university will be celebrating its 50th anniversary. What sort of anniversary would it be? Will it be a celebration of achievement as a center of academic excellence? Or will it be a charivari of complaints about underfunding, understaffing, under-equipping, and underperformance? The campuses of the University of the West Indies in other Caribbean countries such as Jamaica, Trinidad, and Barbados have become platforms for the new scientific and entrepreneurial elite, which are leading those countries, leading their economies into the new millennium. If the University of Guyana is to join that elite club of Caribbean universities, and if this country is to compete with its sister states in CARICOM, there have to be changes made on this campus. There have to be changes made in the way PPP Civic Administration deals with the University of Guyana. We can't go on as we've been going on for the last 18 years. There must be change. The call for increased funding expressed, as Ganesh explained, in the report of to the Council of the University by Vice-Chancellor Professor Lawrence Carrington. How he got in the media, I don't know. But that report was responded to by the Minister of Education, Sheikh Baksh, to the effect that increased funding will be tied to a review of the university's strategic plan. And you should know that the university has had about half a dozen strategic plans in its history. But the report by the Vice-Chancellor and the response by the Minister suggests that the university faces dark clouds and there is trouble on the horizon. The question for you is, when those two entities struggle, when they fight, when the ministry fights the university, who will suffer first and who will suffer most? H.G. Wells wrote several decades ago, human history becomes more and more a race between education and catastrophe. This clearly is the case in Guyana. Catastrophe will eventually win. It will win the contest in this country unless people who are serious about education take control of the situation at the University of Guyana. Only a century ago, the vast majority of our grandparents and our great-grandparents were not regarded as equal citizens in this country. They were treated as intellectually and culturally inferior to the ruling elite. Most of them were legally ineligible to vote in elections. Many were illiterate in English, and they had little formal education. Few had access even to secondary schools, and few still even dreamt of attending a university. Most of them were employed at very low wages in subservient jobs. Today, however, the majority of adults have been emancipated from their lowly status, but emancipated only through education. Tertiary education, in the form of the University of the West Indies, was one of the greatest legacies of the independence movement in this part of the world. Today's generation of students, you, the generation to whom this country must be bequeathed, because the old people can't take it with them, you have to inherit this country. You are the heirs to that education legacy. If we know that you are the heirs to that legacy, why do we still have problems here at the University of Guyana? Why can't we give you something better to inherit? Education is essential to the nation's survival. Yet, in this country, every hour of the day and night, a boy or a girl drops out of primary or secondary school somewhere. It is true. By 7 o'clock tomorrow night, 24 boys and girls would have dropped out of schools in this country. That is the dropout rate. It is a phenomenon. So you can see that in the contest between education and catastrophe, which one is winning? It is catastrophic. Some of those who remain are unlikely to be functionally literate. And people who have been doing registration for ID cards have discovered that. There's massive illiteracy out there. Many of them, of course, are unlikely ever to enter the University of Guyana. But the education system is too important to the nation's future to be held hostage by the pettiness of present-day politicians. Our freedom is diminished by a system that allows academic apartheid, a system that cynically hampers and hinders the education of young people in a not-so-top university. Education at the academic, at the elementary level used to be aimed at training the local masses to function at the lowest levels of the colonial system. But the world has changed from colonial times. People now need to be educated in the sciences. People now need to be enabled to pursue private enterprise rather than to rely on employment with the state. People now need to be educated not only at the primary and secondary levels, but also at the tertiary level, if we as a country are to overcome the challenges of the new millennium. Employment is key because it is the means of social mobility. It is the means by which people make their living. Social change in the late 20th century, however, instead of enhancing education, seems to have become a caricature of plantation society of the 18th century. Too many young people today, owing largely to the deficiencies in the education system, are being forced into employment in the proliferation of personal services provided to the political elite and the professional classes. Even a casual walk around the city would reveal an astonishing record of hirelings, the carers of children, the cutters of grass, the cookers of meals, the deliverers of parcels, the washers of cars, the sweepers of floors, the keepers of the gates. Is this the future we want for our young intellectuals, for our young Guyanese? Do we want a future in which all they could look forward to is providing the services that the elite requires? Where do all of these people come from? These hirelings, these washers and cutters and cookers, they come from the education system. That is what our education system produces in largest number, in the greatest quantity. It produces watchmen, it produces cleaners, it produces menial and manual workers. Our schools now seem to be structured for the role of producing watchmen and menial manual workers, which are the fastest growing fields of employment in the labor market. Our educational system seems to be dedicated to creating a new domestic proletariat. But watchmen, no matter how vigilant they are, cannot develop a country. Guyana needs biologists, botanists, chemists, engineers, geographers, mathematicians, physicists, zoologists, the whole A to Z. Those scientists can only come from the University of Guyana. So we must look after the University of Guyana if we are ever to develop. And to the extent that the university remains underdeveloped, this country will remain underdeveloped. Education promised to free our people decades ago from discrimination, to free them from domination, to free them from the abuse of their rights and freedoms by the people who colonized us. But Guyana is not an island. It is part of a world, a brave new world, in which communications technology and economic independence have transformed human life with staggering speed. Highly educated societies, even in many small countries like ours, have succeeded in providing a higher quality of life for their citizens. They have done so by adopting modern technologies for information and for education. We must do the same to keep up with them. As opportunities for employment in this country started to stagnate, however, educated people raced to migrate in staggering numbers, even to the small countries of the Eastern Caribbean. because the quality of life there was higher than it was here in their own homeland. And in my own experience, I remember sitting down there at the square, and the person next to me literally had his diploma in one hand and his Caribbean Airlines ticket to Bahamas in the other hand. He said, "David, I'm not staying." And he didn't. So our graduates are migrating in staggering numbers because other countries can provide them with a higher quality of life. Many of us who remain here in mudland, or as we've seen in the last 3 days, floodland. But you mustn't say flood, because the minister says it is just excess precipitation. The land, of course, is not flooded. There is something called accumulation of water. So you mustn't say flood anymore. So many of them have gone, we felt, because they felt that this is not a country which can give them the opportunity for what they wanted, the good life. But why is it that this administration, the People's Progressive Civic Administration, over the last 18 years, has been so blind to the shoddy conditions on this campus? Why is it so deaf to the complaints, even from its own appointed vice-chancellors? Go back to the convocation addresses of Professor Dennis Craig, of Professor Harold Utchman, of Dr. James Rose, of Professor Lawrence Carrington. They are all litanies of complaints. The administration's strategy has simply been to control the council, to obstruct improvement. In this way, it merely maintains the university on life support. It mainly keeps it alive without improving its health, without leading it on a path of independent academic growth. As Derek Bok wrote some time ago, if you think education is expensive, try ignorance. And if you listen to the statistics that Ganesh read out to you, you will see that this country is not really being run on anything but on a cheapo budget. It is a cheapo budget that this country, this university probably needs four times what it is getting if we are to move up to the standards in the Eastern Caribbean. It is this cheapo budget which fosters ignorance in the wider community. It is this cheapo budget which creates so much antisocial behavior and criminal violence in this country. What should be the purpose of our national university, this University of Guyana? Shouldn't it lay the foundation for empowering a new, enterprising generation of young people? People who could pursue the good life in a free nation? Education, as has been said before by other speakers, education is an entitlement. Who the hell is paying for it? Is it you? Is it taxpayers? Is it the Guyanese nation? The ministers are not paying for it. The party is not paying for it. This is public money. And they must spend it on the public interest by making University of Guyana better. You're asking for public funds to be directed in the public interest to make the university capable of supporting development. Listen to the warnings of James Bond. Because if you fail to protect this entitlement, we will end up in a state of educational apartheid. Two separate societies, one educated and empowered, the other uneducated, unemployed, and poor. Is that what you want for Guyana?
No, sir.
That was David Granger and James Bond out of Guyana, a forum that was held at the University of Guyana in Turkine earlier this week. David Granger is the People's National Congress Reform candidate for the presidency of Guyana. Elections will be later on this year. We were hoping to have Mr. Granger on live from Guyana, but that did not work out. You're listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple.
For news, views, interviews, and thought-provoking discussions, tune in to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 Eastern Standard Time right here on the Uhuri Radio Network.
Tune in to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 a.m. on the Uhuru Radio Network. We examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. If you're not listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network, then your radio is not on.
This is Max Rameau with Take Back the Land and the Omojo Village. You are listening to UhuruRadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution.
Avant que t'es parti, t'es promettre-moi que wapé, crie-moi. Avant que t'es parti, t'es promettre-moi que wapé, les-moi. Avant que t'es parti, ou t'es dit wapé tout n'est bien, ouais-moi. Avant que t'es parti, ou t'es dit ou papé, j'en m'ai bli. Moi. Mes semaines passées, moi passé ou paré les mois, ou pas qu'un bien promesse que ou t'es fait moi, avant que ou t'es parti, mes semaines passées, moi passé ou paré les mois, ou pas qu'un bien promesse que ou t'es fait moi. Avant que vous t'es parti, c'est pas ça on t'a dit. Avant que vous t'es parti, ou t'es dit ou papé, j'en m'oublie moi. Avant que vous t'es parti, ou t'es dit ou papé, vini chez moi. Avant que vous t'es parti, t'es promet ou papé toujours. Les-moi. Avant que t'es parti, ou t'es dit wapé tout la vie. Ouais moi. Téléphone sonne et qu'aime repassante. Ou pas jamais écrit, relais-moi. Oh, c'est chaque jour m'lever. Ma pétante la poste passée. Ou téléphone sonne et qu'aime repassante. Ou pas jamais écrit, c'est pas ça on t'a dit.
Yes, that is some Creole jazz. Avant que tu partes by Armstrong Jean out of Haiti. You're listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network. We're going to head back to the Caribbean. Earlier we were in Grenada speaking with John Krizik, and then we heard from David Granger and James Bond out of Guyana recorded a town hall meeting that was held earlier this week, and now we're going to head to the island of Montserrat. And joining us is my good buddy, Brother Edgar Nkosi White. Edgar, good morning, and welcome again to Caribbean Forum. It's always a pleasure to chat with you, my brother. And Edgar, about a month ago, there was a moderate pyroclastic flow which occurred on the northern flank of the Soufriere Hills volcano there in Montserrat. The runout still demonstrates the continuing hazard which is posed by the lava dome that remains at the summit. How are the nationals in Montserrat, who have remained, still coping with this continued uncertainty?
What is interesting to me is that those who have less integrated with the at the time of the crisis, more have died in Britain than on Montserrat, okay? People are very aware of that fact. In other words, when people have been taken to places like in England, they put them in the furthest point, closest to like Newcastle on Tyne. You remember the expression, bringing coals to Newcastle?
Absolutely.
It is the coldest part of Britain, and that is where they chose to put the month's rations, you know. And then they turned around and said, oh, my God, isn't it funny that so many are, you know, they're dying, you know? Yes, my friend. So those who will stay say, let me die where I know. Yes, let me go over with my dashing and my breadfruit and my, you know? Yeah, man. So they are totally at peace with that. The volcano has become almost an intimate part of our lives. It keeps people very, very aware of the presence of God.
You spend a lot of time between the United States, London, and Montserrat. Yes. Why are you in Montserrat right now?
I'm in Montserrat because I've retired from the plantation. I'm in Montserrat because I don't want to see any more winters, my friend. I don't want to wait until rheumatism, you know, completely so takes me over that I can't climb these hills. All right, so I've retired now. The rest of the world can have me between the months of May to September, okay?
All right.
It's the only time I want to be outside of Montserrat. Other than that, this is where I live. Every place else from now on is where I visit. Okay?
That sounds good to me, my brother. Edgar, one of your many plays is I, Marcus Garvey, which I had the privilege of doing the title role many years ago in New York. Currently, the play is running at the Paper Mill Theatre in Toronto through March 27th. It spans Garvey's 1912 arrival in London through his years in the United States, Jamaica, and Canada before returning full circle to London in 1938. Now, this powerful story is told through music, multimedia, and six actors portraying 16 characters. The reviews have been rather encouraging. When did I, Marcus Garvey, make its debut, and why do you think his life history is still relevant today?
Well, it made its debut in the Caribbean 8 years ago. Now, at that point, it was first done in Jamaica. It was done at the Ward Theater, first done at the school, actually, the School of Drama. You know, that whole complex with which Rex Nettle at that time, you know, was dealing with. And then it went to the Ward, which is the largest theater in Jamaica. And then from there, it toured. It went to Guyana, it went to Barbados, it went to Trinidad, and every place it was incredible reception. But it's never really had a serious production in North America. It's always been, you know, we've done readings and this sort of thing. People have been very, very fearful. And it's timely that now the director, Roma Spencer, when she saw that first production,
She's out of Trinidad, am I correct?
She was going to do it. And boy, I'm telling you, talk about the little widow's mite. you now want to mess with woman. You hear me?
Yeah.
When they set their mind to something.
Yeah, and woman is boss.
What? You know, and seriously, she set about getting this done in Canada, where she's based. And last year they had a preview, and it was so well received that they swore that they would do the complete play the following year, and she's just made it happen. And the reviews have been incredible. I mean, even what I've sent you, man, there's more that's come out since then. And the response of the audience, they're packed. You know, the place was absolutely packed opening night. So this is good. It begins to sound very much like a hit to me, my friend.
You said the play is timely. How so?
Well, because at last they're ready to hear what Garvey has been talking about, namely, do for self. Very simple message, do for self. And it certainly impacts the Caribbean, that particularly those who are looking to the IMF and all the rest of that, you know, who the World Bank and all that are going to come save us. No one is going to save us but ourselves, right? And we have enough. At one point, I don't even have to tell you about Guyana, but Guyana was the breadbasket of the Caribbean. You know, what happened to all of that, man? What happened? Why?
That's right.
Why are they dependent on the prices in America of rice and all of this foolishness?
As rich as the Caribbean is.
You know why? So I mean, that's why I say it is a timely message. They are now ready to understand that if we don't produce our own food, we are totally manipulated. You know, like puppets. And nothing before its time. You know, nothing before its time. And certainly, it's particularly interesting to me that it's done in Canada, because Canada was the one place that accepted Garvey after the deportation and all of this, when he was not allowed to be in the States, and certainly Jamaica didn't really even want him. Canada did. And the UNIA up there is one of the strongest, I think, in the world.
Yes, it is.
Even more so than in the Caribbean.
Yeah. Yes, because I'm hoping to head up there with my one man presentation in Ottawa.
Absolutely,
in Ottawa.
Believe me,
you
will be well received, my friend.
Absolutely,
because they know.
You know, it's so amazing that after all of these decades, that there are a lot of people who still do not know about Garvey. Just yesterday, I met a sister. She was born in Jamaica, and she admitted with much trepidation that she does not know the history of Marcus Garvey.
Absolutely.
You know, and, I was taken aback, but I've been taken aback many times. Yes.
It's twofold, my friend. They can kill you in two ways. They can either, no one knows your name, they don't honor you, they don't, you know, anything. Or they can kill you the other way by making you an icon. And people don't listen to icons. You know, they can name streets after them. They can put your face on the currency, and it becomes a matter of fact. I've seen the same phenomenon happening with Malcolm X. So many of the youth in Harlem, you know, they're walking around Malcolm X Boulevard, all sorts of things. But in terms of, you know, the impact, you take him for granted.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Both ways are a way of destroying the relevance. And the easiest or clearest example for me is that of Christianity and Christ. You know, what they did with Christ, for me, the crucifixion was not the most cruel thing. I always say that the most cruel thing was the second crucifixion, where they made an icon of the very instrument they crucified him on, the cross, in short, you know, and made it the official religion of Rome. You know, co-opt the message totally. Co-opt the message of the last becoming first. You know, that to me is the real crucifixion.
If you just joined us.
Mindful.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network. My special guest this morning is Edgar Nkosi White. He's chatting with us from Montserrat. Edgar, you recently shared with me a speech that Marcus Garvey made in 1936 in Montserrat. The article is entitled, The Rule of Intelligence, Marcus Garvey Glorifies the Mind of Man. Tell us a little about that speech in the few minutes that we have left.
Very, very powerful. The thing that to me was most timely is that he was here on this little tiny island of Montserrat, which even before the volcano was only like 12,000. But he came here and his message was well received. I was given that speech by someone here we could call Mas Bond. He's now died many years. But he gave me that official speech, and he gave it to me, and I could see the way how he had it, you know, in plastic and then
you know, all preserved.
Man, a piece of gold. And he knew that he said that you're the right person, Edgar. You are the right person. You will know what to do with this. And you know, lo and behold, here's the time. You know,
it is absolutely powerful, and I'm looking forward to sharing those words of Marcus Garvey in 1936. Edgar, the last time you joined us, you talked briefly about a musical that you had written for the late Alphonsus Aro Cassell. Any production date set as yet?
Yes, well, we're hoping to do that as part of the next festival, the Aliogar Festival, which will be coming in November. They've seen previews, and let me tell you, man, the energy is strong, seriously strong. It's only when someone really passes that you realize just how important they were. I mean, everyone knew Aaron liked his music, but now listening and in terms of his insight into what we have to do, it, and always his message was, don't run away. Montserrat is where you're from. Let's make this work, you know. And it resonates. And he was the first one here, really. Well, first very important person to invest in himself. He opened the shop, Arrow Shop.
Here, that's right. He was a tailor,
and he showed what the possibilities are of ownership.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that Garvey talked about, you know, he didn't get in his way of his music. In fact, it made it stronger. And he was able to go all around the Caribbean, all around the world, and yet always come back to this source. This is what fed him energy.
You're still an ambassador to Montserrat.
He lived in Miami or wherever. Mm-hmm. He stayed here, you know. So, yeah, the Arrow is so important. And what's happening today, even as we speak, is the young Calypsonians, young kids, you know, are competing. You're going to have, there are many arrows to come, trust me.
Yeah.
I feel very safe about that, you know. It's really, really good energy. So the play will be done in November as part of the Aliogana Festival.
Great.
And I'll tell you, it's going to have a little competition with Marcus Garvey, because people here, they can, you know,
uh-oh,
he came here.
Uh-oh.
You know, he didn't go to Nona, he came to Montserrat, you know, we have to honor that. So hopefully that too will be done here.
I'm reading between the lines, brother Nkosi. Edgar, recently you paid tribute to the late Ellen Stewart, the founder and director of La Mama ETC in New York City, who made her transition in January of this year. What impact did she have on your artistic career?
Well, she was major. She was absolutely major. As I said, there were three people, but one, the first was of course, Langston Hughes, who actually, you know, encouraged me to write and got me a publisher and so forth. But when I started doing theater, it was Ellen Stewart who was really the person most pivotal in my life. Simply because she did something very strange in her art. She didn't read scripts. You ever hear of a producer not reading scripts?
Unheard of.
Very, very. What she wanted to know, she always said, it isn't, you know, I don't want to know what you've written. I want to know what you see. And so she would ask you tell me about the play, you know, and it's through that, through the words, you know, through the energy of the vision that she made her choice. And she also told me this, which is vitally important. She said, Edgar, you know, not everyone in the world speaks English. How are you going to communicate to non-English speaking audiences? I never thought about non-English speaking audience. Why in the world would I want to talk to, you know, anybody who doesn't? But then it dawned on me, the world And if you are a good writer or a good playwright, you have to be able to communicate on many levels. You have to use the medium of not only drama, music, the heartbeat. You always have to be close to that drum, you know, and that is what hypnotizes. That's what unites us. So she certainly showed me the possibilities of drama. Always in anything that she produced there was movement. You couldn't just stand there and talk lines. You know what I mean? You can't just stand there and declaim. It's all about a continuous flowing energy. And so she was major for me. And the fact that she was a black woman is also major. That, you know, there's a reason she chose La Mama. She is the mother.
She's the mother.
She kept her theater together for 50 years, Ron.
Isn't that something?
50 years without any kind of backing from this, and you know, just
talk about
and she had no interest. You know, no one said it's okay for you to do this. She started off as a seamstress. Mm. Can you believe it?
Talk about stick-to-itiveness.
You know, doing costumes. Yeah. Well, you know, she was the turnaround theater. She saw, you know, and at one point she said, you know what? I can do this.
All right, absolutely. Well, my brother, we're running out of time. Thank you. Thank you for gracing these airways.
Thank you so much, man. And the beauty of the internet is that we can connect. You know, that's our energy and our energy force. So I'm talking to people in Canada. I'm talking to people in Miami. I'm talking to people all over the world. Blessings.
Absolutely.
Garvey will be coming to you shortly.
Absolutely. This is Edgar White from Montserrat. Thank you very much, my brother. This is Ron Bob Seppel here on the Uhuru Radio Network. Caribbean Forum heard every Saturday from 9 until 11 Eastern Standard Time. And we return on Sunday. Sundays from 7 until 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Golden Sunday Sounds. What's your thoughts? They become words. What's your words? They become actions. What's your actions? They become habits. What's your habits? They become character. What's your character? For it becomes your destiny. If it is to be, then it is up to me. See you tomorrow at 7 p.m. Enjoy the rest of the day. Many rivers to cross.
Tune in to Africa Live with your host, Yabinga Zimbabwe, every Sunday at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. as we discuss issues facing African people around the world, from Brooklyn to Brixton, Cameroon to Caracas, here on WhoRadio.com.
Get your news, views, and interviews which affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals by tuning into the Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple here on the Uhuru Radio Network.